Life is complicated. One second you're hanging with friends, debating whether dogs need one or two pairs of shoes.
No, I disagree, because a dog can wave its foot.
Then the next, your emotions have taken over.
Oh, you need to calm down.
What did you say to me?
I think you heard me. You need to calm down.
Do not tell me to calm down. Why don't you calm down?
You know what you both need? To calm down.
The characters on The Hot Wives of Orlando, that's the mockumentary series we've been listening to, they're not alone in being overcome with emotion for reasons that can be hard to understand. It's part of the human condition, and being told to calm down almost always backfires. In fact, telling people to calm down suggests a value about emotion itself, one that perhaps not everyone would agree with. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we're going to get a clearer picture of the purpose emotions serve and why we deal with them the way we do. Our guest is psychologist Bruce Lease. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning.
So I know what emotions are, but when I tried to explain them, all I came up with was the happy, sad things we feel when we feel feelings. Clearly, this is not a great definition. Is there a definition psychologists use?
Well, actually, no. It's very complicated because psychologists and other people who study in this area throw all different words around that could be used as a definition, like emotions are feelings, and feelings are affect, and
they're kind of thought, but they're kind of not thought.
Well, that's a good way to put it. They all come from our brain. The process all starts in our brain, but feelings are distinctly different from thoughts. There's a whole physiologic phenomenon, a whole visceral phenomenon that makes a feeling a feeling and a thought not a feeling.
What are the physiological underpinnings of emotions? What are their biochemical components?
Well, first I want to direct people to the website that you can find on a search engine. It's the University of Texas Health Center. You can just put in UT Health Science Center, Neuroscience Online. They talk about the brain from top to bottom. I am not a brain expert, and there's actually a textbook online that has cartoons and everything that's great for this. So to answer your question, emotion is a brain phenomenon, just like thought is a brain phenomenon. It is very different from thought. It's got its own neurochemical and physiological basis and its own unique language, the way it manifests. The limbic system is involved. I feel like such a nerd here.
Go on.
The limbic system is involved. But most importantly is this little tiny, tiny device in your brain. They're actually one on each side of your brain called the amygdala. And it's interesting because there was an NPR report, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, that talked about how science has discovered that people who are more generous and give the most to charity have the biggest amygdalas. So
that's a positive use for emotion.
Yeah, well, there are so many positive uses for emotion. Emotions are adaptational. They are largely responsible for survival. You know, the well-known expression fight or flight. So to go on and be more nerdy, the amygdala is the integrative center for emotions and emotional behavior and motivation. And fibers bring messages to them very, very quickly. And then fibers shoot them back out. So let me see if I can explain this. The best metaphor I know of for this is the high road and the low road. Okay, so let's give an example. So there's a loud bang suddenly. Let's just say we hear an explosion of some sort.
I hope we don't, but I will go with this for the sake of argument.
However, if in your neighborhood they're bringing a building down, you might hear an explosion and it would be a harmless thing. But your first reaction is going to be absolute fright, startle, fright. It's going to be surprise, which is considered an emotion. So your first reaction will be reflexive, highly reflexive. That's because the sound goes into your ears and it goes right to the amygdala, and the amygdala shoots it out to the autonomic nervous system, so you're ready to run like heck so that so this building doesn't collapse on you. So that's the first reaction. Now, half as fast as that, the same information comes in, but the amygdala also sends communication out slowly through the thalamus, and that information is the information that goes to the neocortex, where we can start to use logic, reason, and thought. to deal with what really happened. So the best example I've seen is when you're walking through, you know, you're walking through your yard and you see something and you get this terribly panicked feeling and you turn around and you run thinking it's a snake. So the information shot from the amygdala to your running system and you go running away from the snake. And this is actually on that UT website. And it's not a snake. It's your garden hose. And as you finally get 20 feet away, your neocortex kicks in and it goes, now, wait a second. Snakes don't have fittings on the end to screw into your, you know, into the side of your house. And that wasn't a snake. So you go back bravely. And so there are two, one part of fear or any emotion is reflexive. It's automatic. It's the amygdala saying, whoops, or wow, or holy mackerel. That's instantaneous. And we can't control that. That's what keeps us alive so that we don't get gobbled up by lions and tigers and bears.
That's an interesting thing because in conversations where people are discussing their emotions, a lot of times you'll hear people getting hung up on whether an emotional response is valid or reasonable. And it sounds like reason and emotion, that evaluating emotion based on rationality is kind of an apples and oranges kind of thing, if I'm understanding you correctly.
The best way to think about it is that all emotions are useful, especially those sudden reflexive emotions. If it triggers an emotion, it is time to take some action on whatever phenomenon is going on in our own personal world. So if I get really angry at a driver for cutting me off, if I suddenly feel fury, that tells me I'm probably not driving carefully or I'm probably in too much of a hurry.
Interesting.
It might even tell me I have an anger problem.
Well, the word emotional is also interesting because the casual use of that term, I feel like it signals not the presence of an emotion, but the intensity of an emotion. Because when we say someone's being emotional, they're not probably feeling something in a mellow way. Can you talk about how we perceive strong emotion as
Absolutely.
A particular thing?
You know, as I said, the initial pathway involves a reflexive phenomenon. But after that, we are totally responsible for the prolonging or the continued intensity of that emotion because humans are uniquely able to feel, at least to our knowledge. Dogs may be able to also. We all want to think our dogs love us. But humans have the unique ability to feel, but then, number two, to deal with those feelings. So intense, strong feelings that persist, you can no longer blame them on the amygdala. You then have to say, it's my thinking that's screwy, because very, 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 very strong emotions for a prolonged time. They're not really normal, and to some extent, that wouldn't be healthy, even happiness, because not everything that goes on in our personal world is happy. Sometimes it's time to be serious, thoughtful, reflective, compassionate.
You say that it's screwy, but I guess something like grieving, for example, that would be something where it's not comfortable, certainly, or sustainable to be in a state of grieving for a really long time. But of course, it also is understandable, and it's not without its own logic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think we fear our own emotions because we don't realize that while they may exist for a long period of time, in the case of grieving, that's a good example, it's not a 24/7 thing. I mean, one of the reasons why it's important to continue to visit people who are grieving after the funeral, like a month, 2 months later, is because the presence of loved ones, the presence of reasons to be joyful, return a person to feeling joyful. It's usually a person who has chronic depression who will grieve every day, all day long. That's more pathological grieving. Certainly a person who loses, you know, the phenomenon of going about your daily routine and then suddenly getting a sick feeling because you remember something that either you weren't ready for or somebody hurt your feelings yesterday. That's the way grieving really feels. You know, you wake up in the morning and you say, oh, my gosh, they you know, my loved one is really no longer here. I was hoping it was a nightmare. But then other things distract us. And then hours later, it's like, oh, I used to do this with him or her.
Yeah.
So.
Well, how are we socialized to perceive emotion, both in ourselves and in others? Are there cultural differences?
Well, I love that you asked about culture because this is some really fun research. Years ago, a researcher based on facial expressions of people from all over the world, a researcher concluded that there are six basic emotions, and those are sadness, fear, anger, love, joy, and surprise. Again, sadness, fear, anger, love, joy, and surprise. So that was based on research cross-culturally of facial expressions and what people made of them, regardless of their language. It was the same phenomenon. So those are six. More recently, with computer-assisted facial analysis, there are four basic emotion groups: happy, sad, anger, and fear. And along with anger, there's disgust, and along with fear, there's surprise. But that's universal. So no matter where, if a person's in a South American jungle, or if they live in New York City, they will show some of the same faces. And interestingly, babies, children who are born congenitally blind who can't see facial expressions tend to have the same facial expressions, these four categories.
That is so fascinating. I guess what I mean by culturally, whether these things are culturally relative, is partly just how we perceive the emotions, or
Absolutely.
How acceptable it is to express certain kinds of emotions to certain degrees.
I was a visiting scholar in Taiwan, and I really had to curb my enthusiasm because my level of enthusiasm was really not what was familiar to the culture that I was in Taiwan. It was very serious I do not know whether these are stereotypes or accurate, but people often describe the Germans, who are very, very productive, as being more serious than us. They oftentimes people from Latin culture are described as more, just kind of sort of happier, more free to express passion. So this is kind of my wild stretch to answer your question.
You also hear about people from different families when they interact with each other, kind of sorting through their own histories of what is and isn't an acceptable form of expressing emotion, and how you deal with, is it sort of, have you been had role models who model the behavior of being stoic versus being sort of eruptive or volatile?
Families absolutely positively teach people how to feel when we go from, kind of the instant autonomic, amygdala response to, using rationality and taking control of emotions. So families teach people to continue or cease and desist in their kids emoting by modeling or by outright saying, stop fooling around at the dinner table. You guys are being too silly. So families teach their children, and they teach their children, and they teach their children how to understand feelings, how to feel by teaching them how to think about feelings. We could spend hours on this because it's really, really important stuff.
I want to get back to learning how to feel by how you think about feelings in a second. But I also want to ask our listeners, what have you always wanted to know about emotions and the differences in how we perceive and express them? Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. The number again is 816-235-2888. When you call, you'll be talking to Bruce Lease, professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center. And Bruce, the idea that you can learn how to feel in a different way by thinking about feelings, that is complex. Can you sort of tease that out a little more?
Absolutely. We have at our very deepest core ideas about ourselves and about the world and about other people and about the future, about fairness, about nature, about spiritual matters. We have all of these beliefs that are more or less likely to instantly affect our emotions. The way we process information determines how we feel. So that's why when you hear a big bang and you're initially startled and you go back over it in your mind and you remember that they're blasting down the block, that's why you're no longer scared. I often use this visualization. I say to people, if someone is within 10 feet of you and aiming a gun at your head, how do you feel? And Gina, what do you say?
I feel not good.
No, you feel scared, a little scared?
A lot scared.
Now, what if you don't know they're there? What if you don't know the gun is aimed at you? What if you don't even know the person aiming at you is anywhere near you?
Then I probably feel hungry.
That's what I usually feel. So it's just the thought, I am about to be hurt, or I am about to be celebrating, or I am about thinking sets up that emotion. It just gets us feeling. So I was very excited to be here today because I really love this topic. I'm not kidding. This was a fun one to prepare for. So I felt excited, but I kept thinking, this is fun. This is going to be good. What did I say to you at the beginning of the show?
This is going to be the best ever.
This is going to be the best ever. That thought triggers some very happy feelings. If I thought, you know, this isn't really my field, I'm not ready for this, I should have known, you know, before, any of those negative thoughts will make me feel bad.
Yeah. You know, are we always in an emotional state of some kind? Because, or are we sometimes in a moment that is devoid of emotion?
I supervise the clinical psychologists, 9 clinical psychologists over on the Lawrence campus. And there's this phrase, euthymic, euthymic, and it means without feeling. And I urge them never to use that because it is my contention that we always have feelings. Now, serene, relaxed, comfortable, peaceful, those are all feelings. They just don't come screaming out.
So that's kind of interesting because in these sort of 4 emotional blocks you laid out before, happy, sad, anger and fear, these, I guess I wouldn't always think that I'm in one of those states, but when you say calm and serene, those are part of happy, am I?
Actually, the original 6 had disgust and surprise separate from anger and fear, but it's now clear when they do this research that fear and surprise are part of the same phenomenon, but the absence of surprise would be serenity. I mean, there's nothing to be surprised about. Everything is the way I – and happy. It'd be those two continua would be very reasonable continua.
The idea that emotions have opposites I think is really funny because, I mean, at least for me, when I'm feeling an emotion, although I can see from the outside that, yes, I mean, surprise and calm are kind of opposites, I think of my emotional states as being really complex and this is perhaps absurd, but they feel unique in the moment that I feel them. Combinations of emotions that I think I've just invented.
No, you are absolutely right. Let me shed more light on that. People think that happy and sad are the same continuum, that happy is at one end and sad is on the other end. You can be more or less happy and more or less sad at the same time. It's called bittersweet. I mean, you know. So there are thousands of labels for all those different emotions that you yourself and only you have.
Central Standard is going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion of emotions, including an exploration of red flags for knowing when an emotional response might be unhealthy and cause for intervention. We'll get to your calls, too. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Today's guest is Bruce Leese. He's a professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center. We're talking about emotions, and you can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. We just spent a few minutes getting a handle on what exactly emotions are, and now we're moving toward other territory, but we've also got lots of calls. I just want to quickly, before turning to those calls, follow up with Bruce about something we were saying before. You were acknowledging that some of my emotions may very well be totally unique, which thrills me to no end. But we also talked about there being these four categories. Can you shed light on what those categories do for us, these happy, sad, fear, anger things?
Well, that brings us to the importance of emotions. The importance of emotions is that they give us a signal about how things are going. They help us organize for action related to the emotion. They signal to others what we're feeling. So they're very, very important. And there are four domains of emotion. They're just domains. So happy, sad, anger, and fear, they tell us whether to approach or run, whether to continue or to stop. If I go into a new grocery store and I kind of start to feel lost and confused, it means I probably – this is not the grocery store that has what I want, or I'm going to need to get reoriented. So those are domains, and those are based on research on facial expressions that are universal, even among people who are blind, people of other cultures. Even dogs smile.
One other thing I want to quickly follow up on before we turn to these calls. We talked about the relationship between reason and emotion. What about the relationship between our physical selves and emotion? Because sometimes a feeling of physical intensity can accompany strong emotions, like the thing that makes you march right over and pound on a door or something like that.
Yeah. Anger or disgust is an emotion when it occurs suddenly that tells us we've got to do something to right this wrong. And it is an autonomic nervous system arousal kind of emotion. It gets us up and going. Surprise also, however, surprise that's a fearful surprise would have us running away, and perhaps anger would have us go towards the problem and want to break the chain of whatever wrong is going on.
Hmm.
So that's physiologic.
Let's see what Molly in Kansas City has to share with us. Hi, Molly.
Good morning.
Hi, Molly.
Hi. I have a question for you. Are you aware of any research that reveals inherent gender biases in perception or expression of emotion, or are these more cultural constructs?
Oh, I love that question. They're starting to see some physiologic differences, and I am absolutely not a physiologic psychologist. I'm not a brain expert. I was just a consumer looking through all this material because I wanted to make sure I included this today. But women and men have different size amygdalas, I believe, and that's worth looking into if you're curious about differences. Culturally, men are taught to not be vulnerable. And many of the emotions that can be found on these long, long lists of emotions under the four major categories, a lot of them are vulnerable emotions.
There are differences, or maybe not, in terms of how men and women feel things. Maybe there are, maybe there aren't. But maybe also, is there a difference in how we perceive maybe one identical set of behaviors, like a woman acting sad and a man acting
sad? Oh, yeah.
Like, do we see those two things differently?
Boy, there's no question about that. First, you have the fact that women have been taught that it's okay to be vulnerable and to be sad, and men are taught that it's not. And then when women have responsibility and they show normal, healthy, vulnerable emotions, they are often judged by both men and women, interestingly, as being weak at what they do. There are huge cultural phenomena that go on with emotion. And like I said, the biggest ones, I think, are what society says is a big boys, boys don't cry. You know, that whole phenomenon is so impactful.
Let's talk to Arlene in Midtown. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. I won't say thanks for taking my call. It just uses up time for nothing. Okay. I had a concussion 8 years ago, 2006. And I'm wondering, like, the fracture was in the back, abreast of the cerebellum. And I wonder if I have very few emotions now. I really have a hard time feeling anything at all. Mm. And I wonder if the amygdala was affected.
Let me talk about it. Yeah, Arlene, I'm sorry to talk over you. I'm excited to answer your question because it is such an important one. The discovery of these different brain parts and how they function. The discovery wasn't based on fancy technology. It was originally based on things like what you experienced, which is damage to a particular area. In one case, there was a man whose amygdala was damaged, and the doctor, you know, there was a big snowstorm, and the doctor called all the patients and said, you know, you don't have to come in today. We can change your appointment. And this person whose amygdala was damaged, who didn't have emotion, had no fear. And so he drove through ice and snow and all kinds of dangerous conditions, and so was hugely courageous because of the damage done to his head. Those emotions weren't there, just like you're saying, Arlene. But what's interesting was when he was asked, when do you want to come back for your follow-up appointment? Because of the lack of that kind of amygdala functioning, it was a very difficult question. Getting in a car and driving in dangerous conditions without emotions was easy, but making a decision was difficult because we use emotions to make decisions. Oh, I'd feel good coming in on a Monday because it'll be right after the weekend. I wouldn't feel as good waiting till Wednesday because, I mean, it's our emotions that help us make decisions, Arlene, and without them, we're more courageous, but we certainly we're courageous because we don't have – it's not really courage. We don't have those feelings. So,
does someone like Arlene have the ability to recover in a way that she recovers that whole emotional spectrum and ease? Or is that something that you – that an injury – is that a permanent thing?
That's out of my league.
Okay.
I'm not a brain scientist. I find this stuff fascinating. But I know that stimulation to that part of the brain will create emotions, and damage to that part of the brain will reduce emotions. So,
Arlene, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Thank you for the feedback. Bye-bye.
Bye. Let's turn now to Tracy. Tracy is in Kansas City. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. How are you?
Great. What can you share with us?
My husband left me after a 20-year marriage 10 years ago and married my best friend, and her husband was his best friend. So the four of us were inseparable for 7 years. And I still feel stuck and sad many days. I just have a lot of memories, like he spoke of earlier, that just pop up out of nowhere. I just wondered if that's an abnormal length of time.
How long ago was it?
10 years.
Yeah, that's far longer than you should have to suffer. You know, there are some really good schools of thinking about feeling better when one has prolonged unhappiness or anger or anxiety. One of my favorite ways of thinking about this, and the school I'm thinking of here, is the school of, like, emotional regulation. There's a whole literature on psychotherapy using emotion regulation. It is important for people like you, Tracy, to not think you can change the emotion. You can't change an emotion. Emotions don't change. What you have to do is choose the emotion you want.
That is much easier said than done, Bruce.
Well, the second part is the sticky, challenging, difficult part. I mean, it requires complete retraining. I totally agree with you. It's like you know, learning a language. Because if you have spent 10 years thinking about a loss and feeling very sad about a loss and remembering things about what was good and wishing it were back again, that is like practicing your native language day in, day out. The challenge to people who feel bad that want to feel good is to find happiness isn't for everyone. I mean, for some people want to feel just, you know, warm towards other people. Some people want to feel just peace. They want to be at peace. They want to feel serene. But
something that I think a person could hear in all of this is that if you're experiencing a negative emotion for a long time, and that you're experiencing it maybe for reasons that, of course, you know, like losing a spouse like that would be painful, but that hearing that you can choose an emotion, or that you're feeling an emotion for too long, could sound like that it's your fault, or that you should be hard on yourself. You know what I'm saying?
I really know what you're saying. It reminds me of our last show, the last show I was on, where we talked about sexual assault and how somebody can, should, might feel who's a victim. What I will always contend is that higher order thinking processes can ultimately prevail. We are very fortunate in being human. It's not anything, it has nothing to do with blame, but more of kind of an exciting positive message that no matter how bad you feel, you have the capacity as a living, breathing human being to choose the emotions you want and then with practice learn the language that goes, the internal cognitive language that goes along with that feeling. So, you know, I don't blame people for feeling bad. I just know that the path to feeling good is to decide, what do I want to feel? Sometimes, here's a good example, Gina. I'll have somebody come to me and say, I'm so angry. And I'll say, why are you seeing me? And they'll say, well, because I'm angry. And I'll say, okay, what emotion do you want to feel? And they just stop short and they say, well, I don't know. So knowing what emotions you want to feel and knowing the internal language that brings about those emotions does solve emotional problems without blaming people.
Yeah, and you mentioned practicing the emotion you want to feel. How do you practice an emotion?
Well, I've had to practice. I grew up in an environment where you know, it was New York City, very, you know, energetic, exuberant, excited. You know, everyone around me was that way. And I had to learn how to practice serenity when I sit in my office hour after hour, day after day, listening to people struggle. I have to practice not feeling their sadness. I have to practice not feeling their anger, their hurt, not feeling exuberant the way I feel now talking to you if they're very sad.
Well, that's probably appropriate. Let's check in and see what Florence in Kansas City, Kansas has to ask.
Good morning. Very exciting show. I'd like to ask the guest, what is the connection between emotions during our wake, when we're awake, and in our dreams?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know the answer, but I can speculate that we feel intensely. I met President Obama in my dreams last week. I was so excited. I woke up and told my wife I got to meet President Obama in somebody's house. And it was, I'm sure that the excitement I came out of that dream with is the same excitement I had when I was sleeping. So, Florence, I'm guessing that you feel the same things. And that's why you have to be paralyzed during REM sleep so you don't jump out of your bed. I mean, that's part of what happens to your body. It gets kind of paralyzed.
Well, we are going to get back to this conversation really shortly. When we come back, we'll continue the discussion of emotions, including an exploration of how advertisers use them to sell us stuff, plus emotional responses to the ups and downs of athletic competitions like, say, postseason baseball games. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, getting emotional today with psychologist Bruce Lease. Right, Bruce?
That's right. That music makes me happy.
Good. It makes me happy, too. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 816-235-2888, like Amy in South Kansas City did. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Gina. How's it going?
Great. How about you?
Great. I'm doing well. Listen, so I'm curious. One caller just called in and talked about her ongoing persistent sadness 10 years long. And so it got me to wondering about EMDR, which I understand people are using a lot in therapy to help deal with ongoing, you know, feelings usually originating from a traumatic event. I'm wondering if Dr. Lease can talk a little bit about it because it seems a little like voodoo, but it also, I've heard, is very, very effective. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely.
And Bruce, maybe say what EMDR is in case people don't know.
I'm so used to the acronym. EMDR.
Just a description is fine, even without what it stands for.
It's actually a variety of different interventions that put together really include predominantly kind of a cognitive behavioral approach to helping people with problems. And it's driving me nuts that I can't think of those.
It is actually eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Yes, that's
right. I am told by a little birdie.
Thank you. Thank you, little birdie. So I teach the empirically supported psychotherapy treatments class at Lawrence at KU. And You know, there was a lot of buzz about EMDR when it first came out because it was showing some effective results. And, you know, when scientists who do research on stuff like this looked more carefully, I think what they found was that it is cognitive behavioral therapy. It is the cognitive behavioral component where psychologists focus on the thought processes and the behaviors that are related to it and the feelings. It's probably that component that makes it work. It's kind of a branding of one of the cognitive behavioral therapies. EMDR is not a therapy that's receiving really strong support in the empirically supported
through research
literature. Through research, yeah. So I have never done it. I have never studied it extensively. I don't feel any negativity towards it. Looking at the research, it's not something that I would work hard to learn how to do at this point, because there are other interventions and approaches to psychotherapy that have a lot more empirical, or that is research support.
We've talked a little bit about the relationship between the physiological and the psychological, our physical side and our emotional side, and the reason and emotion. But there are other things in our lives, things like spirituality that you mentioned before, that factor into our thought processes. And can you talk a little bit about more like the textured human experience and how that affects our emotional responses and our emotional processing? Because we're not just machines.
Right. Well, the beauty of emotion, the importance of emotion, is that it motivates us. It motivates us to do some things over and over habitually, but it also motivates us to seek answers. And most of the things that matter on this planet have nothing to do with the material world. Things like love and health, and I mean, those are not things that are better or worse when you have more or less material things. So when you talk about spirituality, the best way to define spirituality is that it is believing in things that are bigger than oneself and beyond oneself. And again, I like to think of emotions as drivers that drive us towards or away from things that matter or need to be fixed or need to be repaired. So a feeling of emptiness or a point in one's life where, you know, there's got to be more to life than this, this kind of forlorn feeling in the chest might drive somebody to start going to church or synagogue or to a mosque or wherever they might go to find answers to spiritual questions. So I hope that answers your question. And then you asked about the texture. That then shapes a person's views, which then shapes how they feel further.
The marketplace, in many ways, predicts and capitalizes on our emotions. And when we were talking about doing this show, you directed my attention to a great story about something called sadvertising.
NPR, yeah, look it up. Sadvertising, NPR. because emotions... Again, there are two stages of emotion. Stage one is reflexive. It's, the limbic system just, communicating with the rest of the body, wow, or uh-oh, or something like that. So that reflexive process is what advertisers have figured out they can reach in order to convince you that they're wonderful or terrific or are marvelous or, you know, or they make your heart go pitter-patter. And if you look at that NPR story, it's very touching. It has video of very touching stories. They have nothing to do with the product they sell.
Yeah, a certain brand of battery because you feel like you appreciate triumph over adversity.
And a certain company promoting, you know, being a mom because they sell products that they assume moms would want. And you're so touched and you remember the name and you go, oh, they are such a wonderful company. So, again, the sadvertising works. Or a dad who's, you know, a single dad and he's taking great care of his kids. And, you know, whatever he tells you is good has got to be good because you feel so close to this man on TV that you've never met. So it creates a reflexive phenomenon. They want your reflex to be to purchase what they sell.
There is a beer commercial that's been coming on during the Royals games that makes me, like, want to cry. And it's about a dog, I mean, it's like the life story of this dog whose owner doesn't come home one night and the dog's waiting and waiting. And then it's just a message to drink responsibly. And yeah, I've talked to a number of people who are just torn up in between innings over this.
I'm torn up just hearing you describe it. So the dog sees daylight and morning and, mm-hmm. and no owner comes home. I myself have thought, what would ever happen if my wife and I were out and we got in an accident and our dog at home, how tragic it would be for him. So, you know, again, that advertising, I think that is perfect advertising because it relates bad choices to a heart-wrenching outcome. That, to me, is the perfect public service announcement. They tried that with here's your brain and here's your brain on drugs where they crack the egg into the pan.
It was a little less relatable.
Well, what's interesting is it didn't that doesn't trigger emotions. An egg cracking into a pan and frying. People just laughed at that commercial because the amygdala did not send messages to every part of your body saying, this is huge, this is enormous, like a sad dog whose owner is never going to come home does.
But speaking of commercials during the Royals, it has been an emotional week for Royals fans. Can we talk about the relationship between sports and emotion, the ecstasy of victory and the agony of defeat?
Well, the best way to talk about it is to refer to a news or it was something on NPR this morning. And it was about a store that's selling all Royals stuff. And the woman who works at that store, so this is a local show, who owns the store, who manages it, was saying, I've never seen people so happy. They all come in and nobody's complaining about everything. And they're happy to be Kansas Cityans. They're proud of our city. You know, that kind of supports what I was claiming earlier, which is if you pick an emotion you want and nothing in the world, nothing in their personal worlds has changed except that they want to feel good. They elect, I'm going to feel good.
I would argue, Bruce, that this might have more to do with the spirituality we were talking about and something bigger than yourself, because sports fans sometimes, casual observation would be that they are not choosing one emotion over the other, because when their teams are losing, I have seen some total freak out meltdowns. I've seen it.
Right, right. Well, once we program ourselves with thought to believe strongly in the joy or the, let's see, what I have some really strong words here, the zeal, the enrapturement, the triumphance, the euphoria. Once we talk ourselves into how euphoric it will be if our team wins, then it's obviously devastating when they lose. You know, let's see, what's the list say there? Sorrow, neglect, misery, despair.
Despair sounds about right. Well, so people right now in Kansas City, there is, I would say, euphoria. There's a lot of euphoria surrounding the Royals. What do you recommend going forward? I mean, there's still more unknown, and there's still more subjectivity to the whims of this force that is, like I said, larger than us.
I'm going to be really boring here, okay? I'm sure it's influenced by something you said earlier. What I recommend is drink responsibly. You know, the only real tragedy that can come from something this exciting is if people aren't in control of their behaviors and they do things to themselves or others accidentally that are tragic. So don't curb your enthusiasm and also don't do crazy stuff that you're only doing because our team is obviously going to be world champions.
That said, go Royals, and we're really excited, and let's talk to Marianne in Overland Park. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, how are you? My question goes back to the categories of emotions. So, you know, Royals aside, how or where does – it's kind of a two-pronged question. How does thoughtfulness fit in to those categories? That's my first question. And then the other is, I consider myself kind of a thoughtful person. I'm pensive. And my facial expressions don't reflect those kind of emotions. I mean, my facial expressions, like when I'm thinking, are often misinterpreted as anger or
maybe you've got a furrowed brow because you're thinking so hard?
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
So, Bruce, what about the interpretation and misinterpretation of facial expressions and how they're connected to an emotional reality or not?
You know, I can really sympathize with Marianne because I've known very, very kind, good-natured, profoundly joyful people who, for reasons that they don't get to control, sometimes it's just a facial feature might make others think they're scowling. I've had encounters with so many people who say, "I'm so tired of being told to smile." So I'm sorry, Marianne, that is the situation, and I certainly don't think that it's your fault, especially the way you describe it. Thoughtfulness you can call it an emotion. I mean, there are no laws governing, federal or state laws, that govern what you can call an emotion. But thoughtfulness, pensive maybe. Let's call it emotion. Let's call thoughtful and pensive emotions. But it could be that you're a very reflective person. And you're right, there aren't facial expressions. And that's one of the reasons it's not considered an emotion, because there isn't a visceral, physiologic set of correlates that go with being thoughtful. Serenity looks peaceful on one's face. So I don't know how often you look serene. Now, there were two prongs. I'm not sure I got the second one. Did I?
The thoughtfulness kind of unites them. But Abe Lincoln has said, I am told, that every man over 40 is responsible for his face. Can we train our faces to because it's interesting. It is a form of communication, our facial expressions, and we tend to think we're not in control of those.
Oh, but I have a simple solution for this question. You know, again, as a psychologist, sitting with people who suffer sometimes so severely that there aren't even words for their suffering, I have to sit with them and not impose my facial expressions on them as a distraction. And I have to tell myself, I don't say change your face. I say to myself,
it's a tall order.
Yeah, listen well, pay attention. What does that mean to this person? What I do look like sometimes is I'll look confused if somebody's giving me discrepant information, but that's automatic. I don't get to control that. Sometimes I look bored if I ask a question about something really big and profound and the person starts describing, you know, what they ate for breakfast, I will suddenly get bored and that'll be a cue. So, you know, one's facial expressions can change, but the affect or the emotion or the feelings underneath would be the driver of that change.
I've heard a lot of talk about emotions getting in your way. How do emotions get in your way, and how do they maybe help you get where you need to go? Because sometimes an emotion compels you forward where otherwise you would be stagnant.
Yeah, there's a phrase in the psychotherapy world that some people engage in emotional reasoning. They get that first jolt of sadness or anger, and the rationale for slugging somebody in the nose or cutting them off with your car or screaming at somebody, the rationale is, you know, it's I just felt that way. Emotional reasoning is when you think that the strong emotion you have is justification for some act to follow. An emotion is not always a justification. If there is a danger if that is a snake from the beginning of the show, if there is a snake, a rattlesnake in your yard, it is time to run. But if there isn't, then, you know, there's really no good rationale. So,
I think I'm getting that to have an emotion can't be reasonable or unreasonable, but to act on it in a certain way, maybe we have a little more responsibility to engage logic.
The emotion comes and goes, and if you sustain it, it better be for good reason. And if it's not the emotion you want, it's important to not sustain it.
That's all the time we have for today's conversation. As always, Bruce Lease, it's been great having you in the studio. Thanks so much for your time.
Always my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bruce Lease is a professor of family medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center. To listen back to this show about emotions, the emo show, if you will, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. You can sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, we'll delve into the Kansas budget, with recent reports pointing to a more than $300 million shortfall. Call in with your questions about the situation tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Gina Kaufman. The standard's been set. Stick around for Up to Date next.